watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. And welcome guests, I'm Lynn Gary. This week I'm very pleased to bring you a talk by Professor Angela Davis titled The Prison, a Sign of U.S. Democracy, which was given September 18, 2007 at Cornell University. The U.S. imprisons more people than any other nation. More than 2 million are behind bars now. According to a report issued by the U.S. Department of Justice a few years ago, 1 in 37 Americans will find themselves behind bars. The majority of those prisoners are people of color, especially African-American men, even in states where they are a tiny minority of the population. And even though many studies have shown that white people break laws as often or more often than people of color, it is estimated that 1 in 3 black men will be incarcerated at some time in his life. That the U.S. legal system is biased against people of color and the poor, who are disproportionately people of color, is incontrovertible. And Angela Davis will touch on that in the talk you're about to hear. Then she'll go beyond to question the institution of prison itself, to pose the idea that imprisonment is bound up with the American conception of democracy in surprising ways, that it plays a role in how freedom is defined in the national psyche. Angela Davis, a former political prisoner herself, as well as an internationally known scholar, is one of the foremost activists in the prison abolition movement that questions the very validity and purpose of prison as an institution. The abolition of prisons is an idea liable to be bizarre even to generally broad-minded people. When most people think of a prisoner, they imagine a murderer or rapist, a violent person who must be removed from society in the name of public safety. But most people who end up in jail are not there for such reasons, and many serving time even for violent crimes are not guilty, but were too poor to obtain the legal help necessary to win in court, or were too black for an average jury to take their word against that of a cop. The Innocence Project, a nonprofit that helps the wrongfully convicted gain access to DNA tests that can exonerate them, has, since its inception, been responsible for exonerating and freeing more than 200 people incarcerated for serious crimes, who have often spent decades in prison or on death row. The work of an organization such as the Innocence Project has demonstrated that the legal system is unfair. But these statistics also suggest something else that supports a deeper look at the institution of imprisonment. If thousands of people are wrongfully convicted, presumably the actual perpetrators of those violent crimes are still at large, still threatening public safety. What does it mean that the legal system seems relatively unconcerned about convicting the actual perpetrator? What does it mean that we have seen a raft of laws under such titles as the Effective Death Penalty Act that create barriers and deadlines that close the courts to the presentation of evidence of innocence? It suggests that for those who make the laws, imprisonment itself rather than guilt or innocence seems to be the goal. People of color listening to this will not find this assertion quite so strange as white listeners, I think. I'd like to set the stage for Angela Davis' talk by reading you an article titled Punishment versus Healing, How Does Traditional Indian Law Work? Its author is James W. Zion, solicitor to the courts of the Navajo Nation, who describes himself as a recovering lawyer. Zion writes, "Many people are skeptical of justice methods which do not have punishment as their driving force. There is a great deal of disbelief about traditional Indian law for that reason, and there are many who are leery of the growing restorative justice movement. One of the difficulties with, quote, law as it is viewed in Canada and the United States, two English common law jurisdictions, is that it is dominated by legal positivism and its definition that law is, quote, a rule laid down for the guidance of an intelligent being by an intelligent being having power over him," close quote. Western law is built on the relationship of superiors to inferiors. That is relevant to Indians and their nations within the modern states of the Western Hemisphere, because conquest itself may create law as we know it. Franz Oppenheimer holds that, quote, law in the strict sense is found only where one group has conquered another and remains in the territory of the conquered as a dominant caste or class. The resulting social stratification is then rationalized. The inferior group is subjected to punishment for any infringement of the interests of their superiors, and thus formal law comes into being, close quote. That sort of relationship nourishes political oppression, which, quote, is easier when there is a racial or cultural distinction between the masters and the oppressed. Tyranny will be harsher in a state established through conquest of one people by another than in a state where all share the same language, culture, and history. There's a contradiction in the ways Canadian and American law view Indians and their nations. Given these definitions of law and their consequences in states created by conquest, states try to treat Indians as, quote, equals in democratic societies without honoring their rights as Indians. We see attempts to maintain societies where, quote, all share the same language, culture, and history, quote, through civil rights legislation or court rulings, which deny Indian values because they do not fit in an equal protection model. The rejection of Indian nation jurisdiction over non-Indians, English-only legislation, and voiding affirmative action programs. Of course, we all know that history is written by the oppressor and not by the oppressed. Legal positivism is a dangerous and racist doctrine. We must remember that contemporary Canadian and U.S., quote, Indian law is a product of social Darwinists who strongly influenced 19th century thought at a time when the foundations of present-day Indian law were established. Canada attempts to create a multicultural society, while the U.S. is dominated by a white male Protestant authoritarian power structure. In contrast, most Indian societies are genuinely egalitarian in nature. They do not rely on artificial and imposed, quote, equality. For example, a great deal of traditional Indian law is distributive justice, the notion that people should share limited resources. We see that in potlatch and giveaway ceremonies, and in the way Indians look to their relatives for help when they have problems. Most traditional justice methods are based on talking things out to reach consensus. A great deal of the early Anglo literature on Indian justice methods stresses retribution, punishment, revenge, and strong institutions such as chiefs, powerful councils, and soldier societies. The reality is that such may have been caused by pushing groups of Indians away from their original homes into a new environment. The horse was introduced to the Americas by the Spanish, creating the Plains culture, which did have authoritarian elements. More recent research, especially by Indian writers, shows that most traditional Indian justice methods were consensus and equality based. Another distinction between Western and Indian justice is the role of religion or spirituality. Modern constitutional provisions on the separation of church and state make it difficult for Western justice bodies to utilize religion or spirituality in dispute resolution. Traditional Indian justice depends upon it. Western law does not attempt to reach into the mind or deal with psychological injuries. Traditional Indian law does, and that is why it heals. Most disputes are the product of bad attitudes, feelings, or thinking. We use head thinking about others, and traditional Indian process moves people to heart thinking and empathy with others. When there is an injury which creates a dispute, there is anger and hurt. Often there is cognitive dissonance, which is the mind creating excuses and justifications to avoid shame. Most traditional Indian justice methods address cognitive dissonance and shame. They involve relatives. They do not make a sharp distinction between victim and offender. They use a talking out process among relatives, both by blood and clan, to reach practical consensus about what to do about a problem. They use ceremony and prayer to bond people to the process and to involve the spirits in both the path to a solution and a binding decision. It is a process which gets to the bottom of things. Most indigenous peoples have a word to describe group and person solidarity, or as Justice Raymond D. Austin of the Navajo Nation Supreme Court puts it, freedom with responsibility. The Navajo word for it is k'e, the Lakota term is t'ospaye, and the Zulu word is ubuntu. Indigenous peoples believe in individual freedom, but it is exercised in the context of the group. Indigenous justice uses respect, consensus, solidarity, mutuality, interdependence, relationships, reciprocity, and even love as the means to heal in traditional justice methods. Those are values which bind the individual to the group and the group to support the individual. We do not see those values at play in Canadian or American courts or legislatures. In sum, Indian thought is sophisticated thought. It is humanist, and humanism is a value which has been lost in the current social Darwinist climate. Indian law uses emotions and feelings, but rationalist thought rejects it. While Thomas Aquinas said that law is a rule of reason, he also reminded us that humans possess both reason and emotion. Emotion was thrown out the window in the structure of modern Western law as it is found in the U.S. and Canada. Western law is based on punishment, and Indian law is based on healing. Indian justice works because it heals. It should not be taken captive by a legal system based on force. We must take a close look at the institutions and rules which dominate in North America and see that there is an alternative method which heals. We must recognize the forces of authoritarianism, social Darwinism, and racism in today's political and legal discourse and reject them in favor of multiculturalism and humanism. Canada seems to be headed in that direction, while the United States is still afflicted by its sad history of slavery, criminal exile, race conflict, and the fact that a small white elite holds most of the power and money and struggles to maintain its dominance through repressive law. Both Canada and the U.S. have a lot to learn from traditional Indian law and its foundations in genuine equality, respect, humanity, and spirituality. That was an article, Punishment versus Healing, How Does Traditional Indian Law Work? By James W. Zion, solicitor to the courts of the Navajo Nation. Now we go to Angela Davis speaking on The Prison, a Sign of U.S. Democracy. The first voice you'll hear is that of Salah Hassan, director of the Africana Studies and Research Center at Cornell University.
For many of us, Angela Davis has been an inspiring figure, a symbol of hope and a symbol of resilience, and above all, a symbol of resistance, especially in these difficult times when American Empire and its European allies are stubbornly repeating their mistakes and horrors of the past everywhere, locally and globally. At home, we continue to witness the retreat from the ideals of social justice and from the gain of civil rights movement. Globally, we witness empire wreaking havoc and death in Iraq, Palestine, or Afghanistan, while perpetuating a system of global apartheid through their brutal neoliberal policies or through their machinery in the World Bank and the IMF, as they translate into poverty, dictatorships, genocides, and environmental degradation. Last year in the Africana Studies and Research Center, we launched an annual book project. Inspired by the success of the Cornell Reading Project, we decided to assign one book every year, a book that deals with a matter of public concern to our communities, African and African American, and to the society and humanity at large. A book of relevance to public issues which all faculty and incoming graduate students would read and engage in through a series of discussions around the issues raised in the book. We began by adopting Angela Davis's book, Are Prisons Obsolete?, which is an excellent and concise study of the evolution of the punishment regimes and incarceration system in the United States and their global connectedness. It is a book that paid attention to the rise of the prison industrial complex and its intersection with the military industrial complex in the context of globalization and the so-called war on drugs and the rhetoric of toughness on crime and the reinstitution or the gradual reinstitution of capital punishment. In selecting these books, we were cognizant of the inequalities of imprisonment and incarceration rates that have negatively affected our communities. As a land-grant institution at Cornell here, it should be our mission to pay attention to these matters. Many of you know, as a matter of fact, that Ithaca, where Cornell community is located, is surrounded by a prison industrial complex. We are surrounded by a considerable number of prisons, Almyra, Auburn, McCormick, among others, reflecting the disproportionate number of blacks and Latino men and women among their inmates. The book and the public forums and discussions we held around it have helped us to bring to the fore some of these issues and generate interesting community outreach among faculty and students. Today we are proud that these events have culminated in having Angela Davis herself among us here, coming to Cornell and honoring us with her presence and I'm sure guidance and astute analysis as we are used to her or to hear from her. Before I ask my honorable colleague, the Reverend Ken Clark, the director of Cornell United Religious Works, to introduce our guest speaker, I wish to thank all individuals and units at Cornell that co-sponsored these events. Please join me in welcoming my colleague Reverend Clark, who gracefully agreed to introduce Angela Davis.
Good evening. We bid you welcome, all of you who've come this evening, to hear one of the preeminent activists, scholars, and writers of our generation, Angela Yvette Davis. For many of us, Angela Davis's emergence as a significant and powerful public figure in the 1960s is a significant part of our memory. A test of our cultural literacy during that time period was to know who Angela Davis was. An even greater test of cultural literacy was to the capacity to sift through the media reportage of that time to properly interpret her and her work. By word, precept, and example, as one committed to justice, freedom, and equality, as one committed to a transformational politics that challenges racism, economic injustice, sexism, homophobia, and abuses of power by the state. Through her activism and scholarship over these decades, Angela Davis's work as an educator at the university level and the larger public square has always emphasized the fostering of communities of struggle, resistance for economic, racial, and gender equality. Professor Davis's teaching career has taken her to San Francisco State University, Mills College, the University of California at Berkeley, UCLA, Vassar, the Claremont Colleges, and Stanford University. Since 1992, she has been on the faculty of the University of California at Santa Cruz, serving as professor of History of Consciousness in the interdisciplinary PhD program and professor of feminist studies. In recent years, a persistent theme of her work has focused on the range of social problems associated with incarceration and the generalized criminalization of communities most affected by poverty and racial discrimination. In keeping with some of the best contemporary scholarship, her work draws upon personal narrative. She spent 18 months in jail and on trial after being placed on the FBI's most wanted list in the early 1970s. Professor Davis has also conducted extensive research on numerous issues related to race, gender, and imprisonment. Her most recent books are Abolition Democracy and Are Prisons Obsolete? She is now completing a book to be called Prisons and American History. Professor Davis is especially concerned with the general public policy and media tendency to devote more resources and attention to the prison system than educational institutions. As one who helped to popularize the notion of a prison industrial complex, she now urges her audiences to think seriously about the future possibility of a world without prisons and to help forge a 21st century abolitionist movement. In this vein, she raises for us tonight the provocative inquiry that will serve as her topic, Prisons, a Sign of U.S. Democracy. Please give a warm welcome to Angela Davis.
So good evening. Good evening, everyone. I would like to thank Reverend Clark for the gracious introduction. And I would also like to thank Professor Salah Hassan, who's the director of the Africana Studies Center, for having invited me to share a few ideas with you this evening in connection with the conversation that was begun last spring when our Prisons Obsolete was the topic of conversation. I tried to come in April, I think it was April, was it April or May, to participate in those conversations and could not get my schedule together, so here I am a bit late. But I'm here. Let me go on to say something about the title of my talk, which is, as Reverend Clark pointed out, Prisons, a Sign of Democracy, a Sign of U.S. Democracy. And the title, of course, attempts to capture the seemingly, but perhaps not so paradoxical relationship between mass imprisonment in the United States and the claim of the U.S. to provide the most compelling model of democracy for the world. The institution of the prison has played a pivotal role these last few years in the U.S.-initiated global, so-called global war on terror, which is, and, you know, sometimes I have to try not to mention a certain name, a man who fortunately will no longer be our president in about a year and a half or so. I'm interested in the way George Bush constantly uses the term, the phrase, an ideological struggle in defense of democracy. So he characterizes the war on terror as, in part, what he calls an ideological struggle in defense of democracy. And, of course, if we try to recapitulate developments over the last several years, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, the secret prisons in Europe, secret prisons in Africa and the Middle East run by the CIA, prison guards from the U.S. serving as agents of sexual torture in Iraqi prisons, the then Secretary of Defense, there are actually quite a few the thens, but I'll say the then Secretary of Defense trying to justify certain modes of torture, such as forced standing for long periods of time, by indicating that he would not find it difficult to comply himself with these demands. And of course, he said, you know, look at me, I can stand for as long as I need to. But as most of you know, if you consider the, you know, what was done to that hooded figure that became so widely recognized in the sort of emblem of Abu Ghraib, the hooded figure with, well, we know it was a man, his arms outstretched with wires dangling from his fingers, who was apparently told that if he allowed his arms to drop, he would be electrocuted. So I'm glad Donald Rumsfeld is no longer in the picture here. The then Attorney General, claiming that Geneva Conventions were simply not applicable to people suspected of engaging in terrorism. The use of detention centers to remove people from the streets, oftentimes people only suspected of religious affiliations with Islam. You know, all of this, of course, announced new forms of repressive racism. So I want to ask this evening, what is this democracy that is allegedly safeguarded by using the weapon of the prison? If we have an opportunity to ask the president how he would define democracy, I wonder what he might say. How might he define the democracy that was supposed to be the goal of the intervention, the military intervention in Iraq? What would have been a successful outcome? Well, if you recall, when the first elections took place after the beginning of the war, Bush did hail the advent of democracy. As a matter of fact, on the eve of those elections, those national elections in Iraq, he hailed the advent of democracy, thus justifying the pandemic of violence out there. And of course, now we might say that he spoke far too quickly, because Iraq is further away from democracy than perhaps it ever was, even during the reign of Saddam Hussein. But let's turn to the U.S. Suppose, in fact, we do use elections as a central ingredient of democracy. And elections are extremely important. But if we look at the history of the United States and we consider the contestations and struggles over the right to vote that have marked the history of this country since its founding, we might perhaps understand the limits of the dominant version of democracy, which sees elections as the only important standard of democracy. Here in this country, as we know, the right to vote, if we focus on that question, was circumscribed by race, by gender, and of course by wealth. It's been estimated that early in the history of this country, perhaps only about 6% of the population enjoyed the right to vote. This is when the United States was being hailed as a model for democracy in the world. That is to say, it was a democracy for a tiny majority, white, male, affluent, totalitarian for the vast majority. And as all of you know, for most of the history of this country, women were not allowed to vote. White women, especially white married women, were denied access to the electoral arena. Immigrants were not allowed to vote. Latinos denied the right to vote. Asians could not vote. And of course, black people in their vast majority did not receive the right to vote until when? When?
1965.
Yeah, 1965. That wasn't that long ago. You know, those of you who are a bit younger might contest that, but it really, you know, wasn't that long ago. I graduated from college in 1965. And I personally was unable to vote in the county of my residence, which was in Jefferson County, Birmingham, Alabama, until long after I was actually eligible with respect to age because of the policies of racism and segregation in the South. And it might also help to think, to sort of broaden the picture and think about another country in another part of the world, to think about South Africa, for example, where the majority of people in that country only received the right to vote a little more than a decade ago. Right? As a matter of fact, there's some very interesting parallels between the US and South Africa. Historically, and as South Africa attempts to build a new world, a new society, with all of the difficulties they're confronting, you know, one of the most challenging issues is the role of the prison, the role of mass incarceration. South Africa has the largest incarceration rate on the continent of Africa. And at the same time, of course, South Africa has begun to solve so many of the problems with which people are afflicted. Problems with poverty is something like 85% of the houses in South Africa now have indoor plumbing, which is an amazing feat within such a short period of time. But let's see if we can talk a little bit about democracy. How many of you have read Democracy in America? Yeah, the Tocqueville. That one. How many of you have read it? Well, how many of you are aware of it? Sometimes you don't read things, but you know they exist, and you've scanned them a little bit, right? So you can say, how many people are familiar with the Tocqueville's Democracy in America? Okay. That's a bit more like it. Of course, it was published first, volume 1 in 1835, volume 2 in 1840. I don't actually want to talk about that text. What I want to bring to your attention is the fact that he wrote, you know, what remains probably the most well-known study on American democracy as a result of having journeyed from France to the United States to look at the new, exciting prison system that this country was producing. And he visited Auburn, not too far from here. Who knows? He, you know, may have been hanging around in this area as well. But the thing is, he came to this country along with his colleague Gustave de Beaumont to look at the institution of the prison, which was one of the greatest examples of the transformations that were taking place under the sign of democracy here in the United States of America. Now, when we think of the penitentiary as a democratic institution, it sounds kind of weird, doesn't it? Doesn't it? time, if we're not specifically doing work around prison issues, or if someone hasn't brought this to our attention, or if we have not developed the kind of political consciousness which makes us attentive to the political role that mass imprisonment is playing, that we just don't think it has anything to do with us, right? It's just, it's this bizarre space, this black hole where you dump all of the people who have the nasty problems that you don't want to really think about. Now, de Tocqueville and Beaumont thought that this new system of punishment was so interesting and so connected to the new democracy that it might be introduced to France. And they did author a book, mostly written by de Beaumont, but under the name of de Tocqueville as well. The book was entitled The U.S. Penitentiary System and Its Application in France. Now, why would the penitentiary system be considered an institution so intricately connected with democracy? Some of you may know that in those days, during this period, the 1830s, the 1840s, the 1850s, penitentiaries were also sites of tourism. People went to take their vacations in Auburn. And of course, there were two competing systems around that time. You know, there was the Auburn system and there was the Philadelphia system. The Auburn system was supposed to be a little bit more progressive because prisoners were allowed to congregate with each other. The Pennsylvania system, or the Philadelphia system as it's sometimes called, involved total isolation. Involved absolute solitary confinement. And you see this actually in the super maximum prison today. You see a recapitulation of that early assumption that if prisoners were isolated from one another, then they could reflect on themselves. They could establish a relationship with God. They could become penitent, thus penitentiary. Penitentiary was produced actually by religious activists, interestingly enough. And the idea was to give people an opportunity to think about themselves, to reshape themselves, to refashion themselves. Now, here in New York, they didn't keep prisoners absolutely separate from one another. They could congregate, but they couldn't talk. So imagine being with a crowd of people the size of this audience and not being able to say a single thing to another person for fear of being punished. That's not really the point I wanted to make. The point that I wanted to make here is that this new prison system served as evidence of the existence of democracy. And why do you think that happened? How did that occur? What was the process? Well, think about the fact that during slavery, many people gauged their own freedom by the unfreedom of the slave. That is to say, you knew you were free because you could look at those who were not free. You could look at slaves and you could say, I'm not a slave, ergo, I am free. And in a sense, the prison serves the same purpose. It becomes the negative affirmation of the existence of democracy. But perhaps even more important to point out is the fact that the prison as, or imprisonment as a form of punishment, not just as a state that precedes punishment, because for a long time people were imprisoned before they were punished. They were imprisoned before they were executed. They were imprisoned before they were subject to corporal punishment, right? But when itself becomes the punishment, what does that mean? How can people be punished by being in prison? I mean, we don't normally think in those terms because we assume that that is just the way people are punished. But in order for imprisonment to serve as a form of punishment itself, it had to involve the divestment of rights. It had to involve the taking away of certain rights and liberties. Now, in a society that does not recognize rights and liberties, it would make sense to just hold someone in prison as punishment. You see what I'm saying? You have to have a framework within which these rights are acknowledged in order for the negation of these rights to serve as punishment. And therefore, during this early period, that coincided with slavery, you didn't find a huge number of black people in the penitentiary, because black people didn't have those rights and liberties to begin with, at least those who were slaves. And so within slavery, the older forms of punishment continued. The forms of corporal punishment, their whole range of what you might call privatized forms of punishment. But there's another reason why there's a connection to democracy, and this is because, ideally, this institution was supposed to refashion citizens. It was supposed to allow citizens to reflect upon themselves and to remake themselves. That's the notion of rehabilitation. I mean, everybody uses that term rehabilitation, right? And you think that prison should probably rehabilitate instead of punish? Is that what you think? Is that what you think? A lot of you think that, don't you? Well, you have to ask yourself, what is rehabilitation? Where did the idea come from? And how can prisons possibly rehabilitate? I mean, how can you rehabilitate someone if the foundational form of punishment consists in denying them their rights and liberties? So how can a person who has no range of freedom at all, how is a person who's told what time to get up, when to make the bed, what time to eat, when to be counted, when to go to the bathroom, when to, all these, how can that person possibly be rehabilitated by an institution that is only interested in disciplining? Well, anyway, think again about rehabilitation. I mean, not that rehabilitation shouldn't be possible, but is it possible within the confines of an institution whose primary purpose is to rob you of your rights and liberties? So we were talking about democracy and the extent to which democracy is negatively defined by the existence of the penitentiary, the prison, as the dominant mode of punishment. Now, how does this institution close the doors to democracy at the same time? Some of you may have been old enough during the 2000 election to be cognizant of what was going on. But see, that was 7 years ago. Yeah, you knew what was going on, right? You remember the election in 2000 when George Bush and Al Gore were seemingly in a dead heat in Florida? Do you remember that? And who won? Who won that election? Okay, what was the actual vote difference? What was the difference in? There was a difference of about 537 votes there. Right? Now, let's talk about prisoners who, of course, are denied the right to vote. Right? You have the system that divests your rights and liberties, and it's assumed that means you no longer have the ability to participate in the political arena. But in many countries, of course, prisoners do vote. In Maine, prisoners vote. Did you know that? Do you know they have polls in Maine and in Vermont? Did you know they have them in Vermont? Because they don't have any black people in Vermont and Maine. And what's also really interesting, if you want to talk about the disproportionate number of black people who are in prison, some of the highest disproportions are in places like Idaho and Wyoming, and places where you don't expect to find that many black people in the larger population. But the question is, what might have happened if prisoners... No, let's leave that question. Let's let... You know, because it's going to be a long struggle to get prisoners the right to vote, but I think that is an important struggle, the struggle against disenfranchisement. What about those who have already... how does it go? Paid their debt to society. I mean, you hear that term all the time, right? You have a debt to society. This is really interesting the way they talk about the purpose of imprisonment. What about those who have done their time and who get out and discover that they are still civilly dead? Because if imprisonment is the opposite, the constitutive opposite of democracy, then it is about civil death. So if you can say civil life is what we enjoy here in the free world, civil death is the state of imprisonment. But the civil death not only occurs when you are behind bars, it follows you, in some states it follows you for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life. And in states such as Florida, you are disenfranchised for the rest of your life if you've ever been convicted of a felony. Now, what is a felony? What is it? Someone give me the definition of a felony. What is a felony? Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good definition. It is an act, the conviction for which requires you to do more than a year. And therefore you would go to a state prison, or federal prison rather than county jail. You're not supposed to do more than a year at the county jail, though, right? So what's an example of a felony? You said a hot check. Oh. Well, that's true. Yeah, you write a bad check. I suppose you shoplift. Has anybody ever shoplifted? Well, I should tell you that I once had a friend, actually, I don't think I've told this story publicly. So if she ever watches the tape, she'll know who I'm talking about. But I once had a friend, a white woman, who I discovered shoplifted all the time. As a matter of fact, she was an activist and she didn't have a job that allowed her to earn huge amounts of money, but she was carrying all these college bags. This was way back in, you know, back in the day. The only way you had a coach bag was when you were really rich. And she had all, and I couldn't figure out where it came from. And then I discovered one day how she was acquiring all of these things. Now, the thing is, she would walk into the most expensive store and she would steal, and nobody was ever watching her. And as a matter of fact, once she tried when I was with her, and I said, oh, I almost called her name. I said, don't you do this when I'm around, because I'm the one who will end up going to jail. I mean, the point I'm making is that surveillance plays a major role in determining who goes to prison and who doesn't. Why is it that out of the 2.2 million people who are in prison today, a huge majority of them are black? Almost a million of those 2.2 million are black. I mean, why is it that black men have the greatest likelihood of imprisonment? Just a few minutes ago, I was talking to this young man from, what high school was that? From the Green Gorillas? You remember? Ithaca High School? He's very tall, you know, very stunning looking black man in high school. And so he said he had been stopped by the cops 3 times on the way to Cornell today. 3 times. I mean, he was so angry. He was so frustrated. And he said, you know, what can I do? And so I asked him how many times had he been stopped. And he said, I can't even count. I can't even count the number of times I have been stopped by police here in Ithaca. Because they say, I look like somebody who supposedly has a gun, or somebody who supposedly committed a crime, or somebody who supposedly did this. And you see, they're watching people like this young brother. But they're not watching people like my friend. I mean, do you see what I'm saying? I'm trying to make an argument about the reasons why people end up in prison that often have little to do with their behavior, little to do with the crimes they have committed. Yet, we think about, and this is actually where the connection with democracy may come in again. We think about all of those people in prison as a singular entity, right? We don't individualize it. We think about them in the same way the state conceptualizes them. We use the same vocabulary. You know, we talk about recidivism. You know, what is recidivism about? It's about surveillance, really. It's about the extent to which certain communities are subject to surveillance, which means that people go in and they go out and they go in and they go out. They may go, a person might go in California where we have a three strikes law. A person might go in once on a marijuana. Well, actually, you have to have at least, you can't be arrested for smoking marijuana, can you? Here's Julie Butler here, who's my fellow Californian here, so I'm asking her about California. But I mean, a person can be arrested for stealing a slice of pizza, for shoplifting a tube of lipstick, and for having enough marijuana in her or his possession to constitute intent to sell. And with those 3 convictions, that person can spend the rest of his or her life behind bars. And there are quite a few people who are, you know, the 2.2 million people we talked about who are behind bars. There are quite a few people who are relatively petty things. I'm not trying to excuse what people do that often is the occasion for their going to prison, because people do a lot of terrible things. But at the same time, people who don't go to prison do a lot of terrible things as well. And I want us to be able to understand that. Now, I said 2.2 million people. That's a huge number of people, isn't it? What's the population of Ithaca? 35,000. 35,000? 35, what? What is it? 65,000, 66,000. I guess if you include the students at Cornell, it's going to be another whatever. But just imagine what it means if you, to have over 2 million people behind bars. If you put all of those people in the same place, that's larger than the overwhelming number of cities in this country, right? But also consider the ways in which statistics, if you do this work, you have to have statistics. Everybody's waiting for you to pull out the figures, right? I mean, the numbers, that's the hard facts. You don't know what you're talking about unless you can wield numbers. But these statistics are often extremely mystifying. And I'll give you one example to use another statistic. Over the course of a year, something like 13 million people will have spent time in prison. So that 2.2 million figure that we always hear is on any given day. That's just on any given day. If you take every day of the year, then you end up with like 13 million people who've been in or out or in or out. And that's larger than any city in the country, isn't it? Larger than most states. Why is it that this democracy has to incarcerate so many people? Why? Why do you think that happens? Well, someone says it's a business. You're right. It's profitable. It's very profitable. But I really would not underestimate the importance of the ideological role that it plays in letting us know who's free and who isn't. Because we don't consider the fact that that is one of the primary ways in which we are aware of our political status in the society. We can always point to all those people, and we usually don't visualize them as people, as individuals, right? We just think about a blob of prisoners, and they're the enemy. And it's really very unfortunate, because there is so much, just as there's brilliance on campuses, not everybody who attends a university is brilliant. You know that, don't you? And not everybody who is in prison is brilliant. But you do have, amazing things. Let me give you an example of what I appreciate about some of the work that some prisoners do on themselves. Okay. Now, what would happen if I mentioned the word feminism here in this chapter? How many of you would identify with feminism? Okay, I see a man there doing this, and I see a man here doing this. Not this, but this. Well, I'm going to tell you a story about a prison visit I made not very long ago in Oregon. And I visited this maximum security prison, an audience of almost all black men. I mean, which is what you're going to find when you go to prison almost anywhere. It's really scary.